Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Free Speech and Legislators Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 27, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Nevada Commission on Ethics v. Kerrigan. The question in this case is the following. In light of the First Amendment, how strictly should courts scrutinize state laws that require state officials to recuse themselves from voting on matters in which they have an alleged conflict of interest? To discuss the case, we have Supreme Court Advocate Eric S. Jaffe. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Jaffe.
Hello, my name is Eric Jaffe. I'm an appellate attorney here in Washington, D.C. I'm also a member and former chairman of the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, and I'm going to talk to you briefly today about the case before the final argument before the Supreme Court just this Wednesday, April 27th, which is Nevada Commission on Ethics versus Kerrigan. The question in Nevada Commission on Ethics versus Kerrigan started out to be whether restrictions on a legislator's ability to vote, so recusal rules, rules requiring a legislator to recuse themselves from voting on a particular matter, are subject to strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. The Nevada Supreme Court, in reviewing this below, had basically determined that a legislator's vote on a measure before their House or Senate, in this case it was a local legislator, voting on a zoning issue. But the Nevada Supreme Court had determined that the Legislators Act of Voting was a speech act protected by the First Amendment and applied strict scrutiny to certain recusal rules, and found those rules wanting in this particular case because it forced the legislator to recuse himself because his former campaign manager was also lobbying in favor of a particular outcome before the particular legislative body, in this case whether or not to approve zoning for a casino. As the case evolved in both the briefs and ultimately in the oral arguments, that issue became less of the question, and it evolved into a far more sensible question of whether or not restrictions on recusal rules that require a legislator to step away from a vote because a former supporter is also lobbying on one side or the other of that vote violate the First Amendment, an argument that does not depend particularly on whether the legislator's vote itself is a First Amendment-protected activity, but focuses more upon the association between the legislator and the former supporter and current lobbying entity or lobbying person. So what you see, certainly in the briefs and particularly in the arguments early on, is this emphasis on the way the Nevada Supreme Court viewed it, that on whether or not a vote is First Amendment activity, a legislative vote is First Amendment activity. And quite frankly, I think the Nevada Supreme Court got it completely wrong. I think the petitioner's brief, written by John Elwood and argued by John Elwood of Washington, gets it completely right on that score, which is that a vote in a legislative body is certainly not a speech act. It's a legal act. It's a legislative act. It may implicate various and sundry speech activities secondarily, but in and of itself, it is not an activity protected by the First Amendment. It's an activity governed by the rules for voting and things of that sort. So the question then becomes whether the Nevada Supreme Court got it right, but simply for the wrong reasons, because their reasons seem pretty clearly wrong. And on that question, and the argument ultimately got to that, as did the briefs, on that question, it actually seems that the respondents have a much stronger argument to make. So the respondents argue that to force a legislator to recuse himself because a campaign supporter also favors some subsequent piece of legislation in front of that legislator is penalizing political association. It says If someone supports you, you can't vote on things that they want you to vote on. And that certainly seems very much like a penalty for political association. No one would imagine that you could apply such a rule to someone who ran independent advertising in favor of your candidacy, for example. So if the health industry said, you know, support Senator so-and-so, Senator X, because Senator X believes that we should have good health care, and then later lobbies for a health care law, it's insane that Senator X would have to recuse themselves. And nobody suggests such with a straight face. So as the argument devolved, therefore, both in the briefs and in the argument, the question then becomes, why did this particular legislator, so Mr. Kerrigan, have to recuse himself simply because his former campaign manager also was involved in lobbying in favor of this zoning rule that would allow a new casino? He was a paid lobbyist for such activities. And that's where the real engagement happens, with one side, Mr. Elwood and the Nevada Commission on Ethics, arguing that it had nothing to do with political support. It was because he was a close friend with a financial interest. And the other side saying, that's nonsense. The only reason you forced this guy to recuse was because he was his campaign manager, volunteer campaign manager. And it had diddly to do with them being close friends, other than by defining close friends as he was a strong supporter and campaign manager. And at the end of the day, that's sort of where the fight really needs to happen, which is, you know, I think everyone on the court and in the briefs agreed that if there's some strong personal relationship, for example, if your mother was involved in lobbying, you might have to recuse yourself. If your brother was involved in lobbying, you might have to recuse yourself from that vote. If there's a strong business relationship, if you're an employer, if you're a part-time legislator and your employer was involved in lobbying, that in those instances, and particularly if you stood directly or indirectly to make some financial gain, for example, to a spouse or to your child, that's okay to force you to recuse yourself in those circumstances. But there's a blurring of when the relationship between you and the lobbyist takes on a political taint. So what if the reason you're friends with them is because they worked extremely diligently for your election, and that's your sole relationship with them, but they were such good supporters and such strong advocates for your election that you became friends. In that instance, it really does seem like you're penalizing folks for political associations just by slapping the label friend on it, which is somewhat nebulous and vague. Similarly, this notion of, you know, where the financial gain has to come in. You know, if the legislator himself has no financial gain, prospective financial gain from the vote, but your friend has a prospective financial gain, is that enough to kick you out? Obviously, if your own family member has a prospective financial gain, particularly if in your own household, your child, your spouse, that circles back dangerously close to you having an interest. But if it's simply your friend that has a potential gain, is that enough? And in this case, it's even one step removed, because the friend is simply a paid lobbyist who's not going to gain from the result of the vote, but perhaps the person paying him will gain from the result of the vote, which downstream presumably may help him get more lobbying jobs. You can see the ways this spins out into ever more vague and attenuated connections. In that regard, the Council for Petitioners, the Nevada Commission, gamely tried to make this out as an extremely narrow situation that would only apply to the very closest of relationships where there's financial gain to be had, but quite frankly, didn't quite get there at the oral arguments. Try as you might, there were great difficulties in identifying where that limitation actually existed, and it wasn't terribly persuasive, as they had an exchange, for example, with Justice Alito about, you know, your second cousin having some connections, and if somebody is similarly close to you as your second cousin, is or isn't that enough? And while counsel tried to deny that, it wasn't very persuasive. On the other side of this coin, of course, is the notion that you would apply, First Amendment heightened scrutiny to all kinds of recusal rules, even those that did have some potential taint of financial involvement. And the question is, where does one draw that line, and are we now going to perpetually review recusal rules based upon First Amendment principles. Because, of course, just because someone is your political supporter doesn't mean that's all they are. They could be your political supporter and a family member. They could be a political supporter and a former business associate or a current business associate. And those are the dilemmas that I think the respondents are facing, which is it's very hard to write a narrow opinion that would just kick out the obvious cases and not kick out the others. So where did the oral argument go? The oral argument was somewhat revealing, I thought. Let's just sort of start by sort of running down some of the justices' reactions a bit. I think Justice Kennedy jumped off to exactly the right start in recognizing that the briefs had been like two ships passing in the night, with the Nevada Commission sort of spending almost all of its time arguing that a legislative vote is not a protected speech act. And the respondents arguing that it's not about the vote, it's about the association and petitioning activity that precedes the vote, either during the campaign or during the lobbying phase for any particular piece of legislation. So Kennedy seems to understand precisely where this is going and sort of gets that even if he doesn't think a legislative vote is speech, which most of the courts seem to be pretty skeptical of, there is this other problem of penalizing association and lobbying by restricting a legislator's vote. So the vote as conduct rather than speech is nonetheless takes the form of the penalty on other association and petitioning activities, right? Forbidding the vote is the consequence or the cost of otherwise protected association and petitioning. And that's the right way to look at this case. It's clearly the right way to look at this case. And I think Kennedy has, based on his questions, he certainly understands that and seemed at least, I thought, pretty sympathetic to the notion that this recusal rule in particular seemed to burden speech, not the vote, but the association, by being extremely vague and by applying to situations where the closeness of the relationship was measured almost entirely by political association rather than by some more personal association or private gain-based association. So Kennedy, you know, seems like he's a potential candidate for voting to affirm. Scalia, by contrast, was extremely hostile to the First Amendment argument, but mostly because he was hostile to the notion, A, that legislative voting is speech, and B, that courts would be reviewing internal ethics rules in any event. I think his hostility is very interesting and very well taken, in that you really don't want the court spending a lot of time reviewing the rules of the House or the Senate, for example, and mucking around in their internal procedures. On the other hand, at the point that those rules become a proxy for sort of campaign finance regulation, so they spend, you know, so what you're doing is you're penalizing, you're using the penalties on the legislator to effectively penalize other people's speech and petitioning activities. So you're saying, we won't let your favorite guy vote if you spend too much money supporting him. We won't let your favorite guy vote if you're lobbying for your legislation. Those look a lot more like penalties on the supporters than they do on the legislator, though it's obviously a penalty on both. And they ultimately become a substitute for the more typical campaign finance restrictions. So instead of saying, you're outright forbidden from running independent advertising, you know, independent advocacy and independent campaign advertisements in favor of your favorite candidate, what they say is you can run those ads all you want, but if you run them, he won't be able to vote on the things you care about. You can see the analogy there to campaign finance, and that analogy perhaps might bring Scalia around at the end of the day to a different way of getting to the First Amendment issue that is not about whether internal activities within a legislator are subject to review, but whether when those internal rules start implicating external free speech activities, whether that is subject to review. But who knows? Scalia seemed pretty hostile and might well vote to reverse. As for the other justices, it struck me that there was a mix. So Justice Roberts seemed pretty sympathetic to the First Amendment position. I thought Justice Alito seemed pretty sympathetic to the First Amendment position. So combine Roberts, Alito, and Kennedy, and that gives you three votes that might be there to affirm, though presumably on grounds other than those below. On the other side of it, so then you have Scalia, who seemed reasonably hostile, and I sort of thought that Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were potentially hostile to this, whereas Breyer was possibly hostile, though somewhere in the middle, and maybe would find this a closer call. But given the analogy to campaign finance, one suspects that Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, seeing the implications that this has for other campaign finance activities, might well lean in favor of reversal and against the First Amendment in this particular instance. So that sort of gives you three and three, or maybe even four folks against the First Amendment position and three folks in favor of it, with the only folks left being Justice Thomas and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Thomas, of course, didn't ask questions, but one could imagine that he would tend to lean in the direction of the First Amendment, particularly where the campaign finance implications and analogies are more clearly drawn. So let's call it four and four at that point, and what you have left is Ginsburg. And Ginsburg seemed extremely skeptical of the restrictions in this case. So if you were going to take sort of a speculative thumb in the air, how is this going to come out, it seems like it's going to come out very much the way other campaign finance cases come out, except that Scalia and Ginsburg might switch places. So instead of the sort of five Republicans on, in favor of free speech in the campaign finance context and the four Democrats against it, you might have Ginsburg coming out on top because this is bizarrely vague, and Scalia coming out on the bottom because this infringes too much on legislative activities in a way that he thinks courts shouldn't do. But who knows? I could just as easily see Ginsburg going with the anti-First Amendment position. I can just as easily see Scalia ultimately being brought around and sticking with the usual pro-First Amendment folks on a very narrow theory that doesn't declare a legislative vote to be speech, and then you would get a more typical campaign finance result. I think those are also possibilities, but it's equally possible that both Ginsburg and Scalia go with the anti-First Amendment side, so they vote to reverse the decision below and find no First Amendment encroachment here. That wouldn't shock me either. But overall, it's quite interesting. I think at the end of the day, what is worth taking away from this case is not what made the news and is not even what ultimately I think had caused it to be granted in the first place. This is not so much about whether a legislator's vote is something protected by the First Amendment. I think the answer to that is no, it is not. It's an act. It's not speech. It's a legal act. It's the act of voting, which is not in and of itself a First Amendment activity. And to that extent, the Nevada Supreme Court will probably be stepped back and told that regardless of whether it got to the right result, its reasoning was certainly mistaken, and that will clear that up. It's more important to think of this almost as a campaign finance case, and the question then is what forms of association and lobbying are deemed corrupting or potentially corrupting of a sitting legislator. So if a sitting legislator is going to be corrupted by the fact that a friend is lobbying or that a prior campaign associate is lobbying or that someone who ran ads for them is now lobbying, that is a quite remarkable result, and a result that I think will give the court pause, which is why I think they might ultimately affirm the case here. But that seems to be the implications of Nevada's ethical rule, which is certain political activity, if combined, if you can sort of characterize it as having led to a friendship, is enough to cause the politician who was being supported to have to recuse themselves. And it's just a backdoor way of enforcing certain kinds of campaign finance restrictions that couldn't otherwise be enforced directly. And that's what, at least to me, makes this case interesting, is trying to draw the line between sort of personal and familial interests and relationships that validly cause a conflict of interest and political relationships that can't validly be the basis of a conflict of interest, because after all, such political relationships are precisely what our system of government's about. People support you because they think you're going to vote in a way that they like, because they agree with the positions you're going to take. But if their support for you suddenly made it impossible for you to take the very positions that they want you to take and they'd like you to take and that they're supporting you for in the first place, well, the whole system collapses upon itself. So that fine line between personal stakes and business relationships versus political relationships is something that the court's, I think, going to have to draw, whether here or elsewhere, and is the legitimate portion of the respondent's argument, is the truly troubling portion of the respondent's argument. Whether this case is the best vehicle for that, given the way the opinion below was decided, who knows. But I think that there is a very good chance at the end of the day that the First Amendment position will prevail, that this case will be decided in favor of Mr. Carrigan, so they'll affirm this, though, on grounds other than the grounds of the Nevada Supreme Court, and that they will say that a political relationship is not enough to trigger recusal, because that's at least protected association activities, and the subsequent lobbying is protected petitioning activities, and you can't have recusal for that, while trying to do minimum damage to recusal for more personal or business relationships where there really is some prospect of gain to the candidate or the legislator himself or to the legislator's family. But in this case, the law will be deemed too vague to address those issues and too prone to sweep in other political relationships that are not proper bases for recusal. So I would look for, I suspect we will see a 5-4, though a 6-3 is certainly possible. And then the question is just which way that 5-4 will go. If I had to guess, I would guess that it will be in favor of the First Amendment, with a decent chance of Scalia and Ginsburg switching sides in the usual, from their usual campaign finance votes. So we'll have to see about that. But it seemed extremely hard to defend this ethics rule as it was written, and I thought ultimately on the association and petitioning arguments that the respondent had the better argument. So that is what I have to say about the Nevada Commission on Ethics versus Carrigan. I'd like to thank the Federal Society for giving me this chance to talk about the case a little bit, and you for listening, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.